And you've been listening to a ball game for a number of hours. We're going to continue with a discussion of an interesting angle with in sports life and the sports world. And we sort of shift from the game itself to many other games and to marketing issues. My guests are the authors, three of them, of a new book titled The Elusive Fan, Reinventing Sports in a Crowded Marketplace. They are, by name, Irving Rain, an old friend of ours, professor of communication studies at Northwestern University, Philip Kotler, professor of international marketing at the Kellogg School of Business at Northwestern, and Ben Shields, a doctoral student in communication studies at Northwestern University. And gentlemen, I want to give you a preliminary thought. As I was reading your book today, it occurred to me, the nation is flooded with illegals. Jihadists and malign nations are hoping to topple America as a world power, and maybe to kill a lot of us. We are the fattest nation in the world, except for certain Polynesians, and we get fatter and fatter all the time. A new study is just out to that effect. Political corruption and mendacity flourish even as voter apathy increases. Cities are in traffic deadlock even as gas costs rise. And now, I learn from you this horrible news: sports are increasing danger of losing their fans. Can the civilization survive if sports begin to lose their fans?
Well, I think you're over-dramatizing a little bit, Milt. But the fact is that sports is really the most competitive, the most fragmented marketplace that we have in probably in the entire globe. Not only do we have sports nationally, for Major League Baseball and football and paintball and you name it, but we have soccer, rugby, cricket. All sports are interested in coming here in one way or the other. And so you have a marketplace that's really overloaded, and yet you have a lot of money that's involved also.
I learned from your book that there is a very, very active sports marketing culture, one might say, and that the basic assignment is make the game more attractive, work up all sorts of other things that will keep fans interested and keep them spending, whether spending for actual attendance or spending on many other things involving the game that you've interested them in. And if they're not interested in the game enough, change the game.
Yeah, absolutely. It turns out that I guess we paid a lot of attention to sports because it was a diversion from our ordinary lives. It took us into a kind of a combat zone where we could get the blood rushing and so on. But it turns out that it's moving very much into entertainment now. People are so busy and there's so many things for them to do that unless you can use an entertainment hook, you're not going to get their time and attention.
Now, actually, Irving has worked for Major League Baseball on an advisory commission to alter the game to bring in more fans or keep the present fans involved.
That's correct.
And you made some recommendations. What were they?
Well, the issues, I think, were that baseball has always faced a changing marketplace. So, for example, in 1961, Major League attendance was 31 million.
I have to invite you to do all of this in 1 minute, and then we'll come back to it right after a newscast.
Okay, well, sharpen, I think, speed up the game.
This is, I'm asking you to speed up your commentary.
Right, speed up the game. The umpires, for example, are watching how fast pitchers pitch, whether hitters get into the box or not. You see a different kind of graphics on television, much more interaction. For example, between a pitcher throwing the ball, you might see 13, 14 intercuts, where before you might see the camera out in center field. You see much more coordination among the clubs in terms of cooperating on charities and various types of marketing activities.
Making the visual, as seen on television, more lively and more active is going to not only please the TV viewer, but will motivate him to buy tickets and go to the ballpark?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, going back to the early 1950s, when baseball and all other sports were very concerned about whether television would ruin their sport, the fact is that it's basically enhanced it.
More of all of this anon. We cannot do justice tonight to the very extended and fascinating book written by Irv Rain, Philip Kotler, and Ben Shields, titled The Elusive Fan, Reinventing Sports in a crowded marketplace. We can't do justice to it because there's so much in it, but we can poke around in it and have some fun. And I gave you guys an assignment just before we went on the air, and I'm going to ask Ben Shields to respond to that assignment. I asked you, invent a new sport, something that doesn't yet exist, but which might attract people, and show me how you're really going to attract them and build a new kind of sports institution.
Well, what we're going to do is reintroduce the game of marbles.
Marbles.
And turn it into a sport.
I used to be pretty good at that.
I'm sure you were.
As a kid on the streets of Brooklyn, yeah.
Sure. Well, what we're going to do is basically infuse technology in marbles. We're going to have a fantasy marble league. We're going to have a marble video game.
Uh-huh.
We're going to have a marble website. So we're basically going to take the marble game and turn it into a media product.
But, you know, I can't quite remember what the rules were of the marble game.
Well, you basically had the marbles, you dug a hole on the ground,
yeah,
and you tried to shoot the marbles out of the hole and take the other people's marbles from the other participants.
Yeah, we could.
We'll invent the rules.
Well, had a hole, it was a circle.
Yeah. Well, it was a circle, but listen, sometimes you were playing in the playground.
Yeah. We played actually on the curbstones of the streets of New York City.
We have a branding statement, too, I think. Have you lost your marbles?
Excellent.
We're going to make that an international concept.
But how do you get people to actually come and buy tickets and watch? Well, it's hard to see marbles from a grandstand, isn't it?
You've seen paintball. Paintball has 10 million participants in this country yearly.
Not really.
Equipment is over $400 million people are spending on paintball. If paintball can do it, right, splashing, you know, splat, bang, if they can do it, we can do it with marbles.
Well, let me understand about paintball. Do people come and watch paintball competitions?
Some people do, but basically it's participatory.
Everybody
is
trying to splatter everybody
too,
up.
It's televised. It's big on, you know, it's big on the cable.
Yeah. Well, if you're going to make marbles a national or an international competitive sport, will you be have marble teams performing in stadiums? Or
you're gonna have marble stars. Yeah. We're gonna brand people. We're gonna have the Tiger Woods of marbles.
Yeah.
You know, and we're gonna have maybe the Michael Jordan type. I mean, we're gonna have different typing and character. In the book, we talk about how the concept should be developed, and type and character is something that sports operations have not done very well with, and so we need to develop the concept.
You know what, we'll probably have to get some stars playing marbles again. People who are right now high visibles, so that their personality introduces others to the game just because you're interested in them.
We're going to get a Charles Barkley type, I think. You know, somebody
once they leave basketball, they go into
actually, it'd be great.
Marbles instead of golf.
He could stoop, you know, and get down and do this and make outrageous comments.
You know, Milt, there are new sports being invented all the time. I just recently heard about the sport of walking backwards or running backwards up a mountain. And it's a new one, and very popular in Scandinavia, where you're just seeing, can you get up to the mountain faster walking backwards?
Well, I've seen backward walkers in competition someplace or other. At least I've seen them on television. Yeah.
How about crawling? We could have a race of people who crawl.
People who, you know, one thing I really would love to see, my sports activity was track and field when I was a young guy. And of course,
did you participate in?
I did some of the running events, and particularly some of the sprint events. But what I loved and wasn't good at all was pole vaulting.
Oh,
that takes a lot of.
It takes a lot that I didn't have.
Right, right.
But I did bang up my knees, and 50 years later, 40 years later, I needed knee surgery. Wow. As a matter of fact.
Yeah.
I think the pole vault, properly executed, is just one of the most glorious sights when it comes to human prowess. Now, there's attendance at track and field events. There's television coverage, at least at the time of the Olympics. But I feel track and field deserves much more attention than it gets and is potentially a source of much more revenue than is presently earned. Do you agree?
Well, I think one of the major issues with track and field comes down to credibility.
Yeah.
At a certain point, you've got to have athletes that are credible. And unfortunately, we've just witnessed a number of athletes who have tested positive
that are credible and not doped
drugs.
Up is what you
that's
mean.
Correct. Right. Yeah. So I mean that's a major boundary for track and field, at least in the present day.
Another issue, Melt, is that social currency has become a very big thing in sports because of television.
What does that mean?
It means that people, you know, it's water cooler talk. You know, people watch Monday Night Football or watch some event and they talk about it and it's part of their lives.
Yeah.
And track and field has just about disappeared from the radar. Partly, I would agree with Ben about the credibility issue.
But, that was the first great interstate competitive sport in the world. The Olympics.
Back to the Olympics, sure.
Exactly.
And boxing is another sport that's been in decline for the last 30, 40 years.
Really?
And if you look at boxing going back 80, 90 years ago, it was the premier, you know, there's three premier sports, really. It was horse racing, boxing, and baseball. And of the three, only baseball is still a premier sport in this country.
Well, what went wrong with boxing?
Corruption, the lack of people who really wanted to, you know, really, really were desperate to fight.
And star power. I mean, you know, when you had Joe Louis, lasted 11 years defending his title. 25 times he defended it. And we all wanted to watch him do it the 26th time before he
resigned.
And we
had the same reaction to Muhammad Ali, did we not?
Yes, yeah. Yes. When you get a personality like that, it makes a difference.
But place connection was really important, and so was nationality. I mean, it was the Irish versus the Jews versus the Italians versus the African Americans. And people were living in the city. They could identify with it. They you know, it was a very strong kind of thing. But then you saw exploitation of the athletes, which has occurred in track and field in the same way, and it lost its credibility. Also, saturation, which is a big issue in our book, saturation, because there's so much activity on. I mean, the average person has what do we say? How many hours of leisure a week?
It's about 18 hours a week
of leisure,
mm-hmm.
Right? And of that, you know. That includes the number one leisure sport of all time is book reading, but everything else, you know, kind of falls somewhere. And the fact
it's actually book buying. I don't think people read the books they buy.
That's true. That's you're flipping through the pages, but the fact is that there's a constant strain on time. And if you look at the youth, that's the most elusive of all fans.
Well, one very big complaint that you get from some people people in the health profession certainly is that there's a great deal of interest in sports. The trouble is that it's not participatory. The more you turn, you generate and create sports fans, the less you get people out on the field kicking balls or running around and maintaining their proper atherosclerotic viability.
Yeah, but I think that we're all going back to exercise, and maybe it takes the form of joining marathons, for example, or
we do get a lot of marathon runners, don't
yeah,
we?
And I have a sense that the couch potato kind of thing is going to go down a bit, and we're going to get back into some participatory sport.
But no, seriously.
And, you know, they're doing it by grades now, age grades. We have some friends who swim only in the 50-55 age range. So you don't have to stop your sport because you're getting older beyond, you know, being at the...
But, Phil, seriously, is it not the case that the more you make people into sports fans who are absolutely enslaved to baseball or to football or to basketball or to something else that you've rendered temporarily popular, the less they will, less time they will take to go out and use their own muscles. Less time they'll take to even go out and play a game of golf.
Mm-hmm.
There's no evidence, Milt, for that. I mean, it's not an either-or proposition.
You can be both.
You can be
a participant.
Both. People who like tennis. Yeah. Who play tennis are usually the most avid tennis fans.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, I think golfers are the same sort. It depends on the sport, depends on the circumstances. Certainly a bear fan who just sits in front of the set is an issue. But, you know, they may have other activities. For example, dodgeball. I mean, people can be a bear fan and also be part of the Dodgeball Association, which is another sport that, like marbles, but there's 300,000 people who are members of the Dodgeball Association in this country. Mm-hmm. And that's just old-fashioned playground dodgeball mm-hmm. now with rules.
I guess there are sports that are flourishing, if only in an amateur way, that we don't know much about.
Well, yeah.
Unless you're a specialist, as you three guys are.
Well, you know, we were talking about track and field and boxing earlier.
Yeah.
And that just basically illustrates a major premise of the book. That is, traditional assumptions about the sports marketplace have now been turned upside down. When you've got the NHL Stanley Cup Game 1 of the biggest event of the sport being outdrawn by the Women's Softball College World Series, that illustrates a major, major sea change in what's going on in sports today.
That's a terrible social fact, but apparently it is correctly stated.
That's correct.
How does one explain it?
Well, I mean, it's changes in the marketplace. I mean, in that specific instance, we've had a fantastic movement in terms of women's sports. And so you've got increases in softball, soccer, field hockey that are now challenging traditional professional men's hockey.
I wonder if some of it isn't the touch on the prurient, or at least the voyeuristic side. When I watched the Olympics, which I didn't do much, women's volleyball was of particular interest, in part because of the svelte and attractive women mm-hmm. who were pounding the ball with both hands.
Yeah, we can figure out whether what the audience split is watching women sports, what percentage are really watched by men versus women.
Uh-huh.
We're looking for some evidence of that, because the intuitive thing is that women are basically watching the women's sports, but I think the men get a kick out of that too.
Well, there's a basic rule that famous psychoanalyst Theodor Reich gave years ago. It was his observation of ambulatory behavior on Fifth Avenue. Said when he walks down Fifth Avenue with his wife, he notices that all the men are looking at the women, and all the women are looking at the women. And so, that's the same phenomenon yeah. you're talking about.
Sure, it is a gender issue, but I mean also in sports like snowboarding. Snowboarding is a spectacle. Fans watch snowboarding to see the flips, to see the outrageous athletic ability of someone like Shaun White. So, I mean, you mentioned the example about volleyball, but there's also a spectacle aspect to some of these new sports that are yeah. driving interest.
I'll give you an old sport which flourishes elsewhere, but which is illegal here. But even if it were legal, I wonder if it would work. And that's bullfighting.
Right.
When I've been to the Plaza Mexico in Mexico City.
Big draw.
Oh, my God, what yeah. a draw. And what an exciting setting. Mm-hmm. And the fans are in a state of transport.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting yeah. is that a sport that's very much on the rise is bull riding.
Mm-hmm.
And oh, yes? it's become, because of television, which has been the driver of many sports. But ironically, television has become also the problem in the sense that it also creates saturation problems. And so sports find themselves in competition with each other. Football season's coming on us right now, and there's just seemingly thousands of games everywhere, whether it's high school, a college or a professional. In fact, Friday night has become a free-for-all. Friday night was always high school sports night, and that was it. No professional or college team would ever move in on that particular
quick night. Survey of the three of you. If you had an hour or two at home on television and you wanted to look at sports, what would you go searching for?
I would manage my fantasy team.
You wouldn't just look at a real game on television, then?
I would say most likely I would manage my fantasy team.
Your fantasy team is in what sport?
Well, in all of them. I'm just about ready to draft my football team.
He's doing a dissertation on that. That helps.
I see.
In my case, I would watch billiards.
Billiards?
Well, that's a sport.
Oh, it's fascinating.
Yeah, mm-hmm. it is. And
great art in billiards.
And I can't believe some of the shots that they're able to pull off.
Yeah, and we do see some of that on television,
yeah.
don't we?
Yeah.
I would wait for that another Chicago White Sox World Series.
That'll be in another one. And we will continue this colloquy direct. And I think we need to talk about the importance of sports, not only in the big leagues and not only as making millions for people like Jerry Reinsdorf and his partners, but sports in the university world, and even for that matter in the secondary school world, where increasingly institutions depend upon the draw of their teams. We return to Irving Rain, Philip Kotler, and Ben Shields, the co-authors of the new book, The Elusive Fan, which is just recently published by McGraw-Hill. And the conversation continues right after this. And directly back to Irving Rain, Philip Kotler, Ben Shields, the co-authors of the new book, The Elusive Fan, Reinventing Sports in a Crowded Marketplace. What sort of reinventing have they done at the college level? Indeed, what have they done at Northwestern? Northwestern became a football power a few years ago.
Well, it did, but in terms of reinvention, we're now introducing newer sports, like, for instance, the women's lacrosse team is an excellent example of reinvention. In other words, in college football, it's always been conventional wisdom that you have to have a football team mm-hmm. to brand your program. But now, since the sports market is fragmenting, there are new sports available, sports like lacrosse are breaking into the market.
What sports are like lacrosse?
Lacrosse, field hockey, soccer. In other words, non-traditional sports, when we consider traditional sports, basketball and football.
Well, of course, soccer is the world's traditional sport, except here.
Yeah, right.
That's
right.
True. That's
which
right.
is a great question. That's
well,
never
it's
been
hard
answered,
to find
probably.
The season in which you should phase it in. There's so many, you know, we're all locked in to the other sports.
Yeah. But soccer's done something interesting. I mean, people keep on saying, when is professional hockey, soccer going to make it? And what they've done is they've built new stadiums, smaller stadiums of 20,000, 25,000, mm-hmm. and in which they own these stadiums to really try to market and brand themselves as very specific.
You mean American soccer teams?
Yes, American soccer teams. In other words, before that, they were playing in football stadiums in various places. This way, they can control the signing, they can control all the aspects, the food, everything that operates in a stadium. So that's their major strategy right now.
You guys are all from Northwestern, and you know that I'm from the University of Chicago. And one of the great comments about intercollegiate sports was given by Robert Hutchins when he took the University of Chicago out of the Big Ten. And when the reporters said to him, but Professor Hutchins, what do you do when you feel like exercising? His famous answer was, I lie down until the feeling passes away.
Right.
The note there, of course, was that sports tended to corrupt the university or deflected it from its true intellectual mission, and you'd have a better university, mm-hmm. given the real purposes of a university, if you got rid of high-powered intercollegiate competition.
Well, what happened at University of Chicago was that, and people forget this, is that the sport wasn't decline in the 30s. It was a power in the teens and the 20s. In the 30s, it began to fade and not do as well. But the question here was always, what would the university be like without football? Mm-hmm. And the experience of young people coming to the game, enjoying what would considered a 180-degree type of experience. And Chicago ultimately reintroduced football.
Yeah, but of course in a very different kind of league.
Yeah,
but still did
three.
It. Still did it.
Yeah. Well, maybe if they had continued with their football, they wouldn't have had the 70-plus Nobel Prize winners.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's an either-or situation.
Well, we'll never know. But, you know, colleges are, many of them have this problem of trying to figure out what to do with their stadium, which might be seating 30,000 people, and they're only getting 10,000 fans coming in. And there's a rule now that certain football teams, college football teams, have to have over a two-year period an average of, was it 12,000 or 15,000?
15,000.
Yeah, so there's several teams that they may want to take out of Division I because they're not attracting.
Well, now, there are sports marketing consultants, and your book, The Elusive Fan, which could be read by anybody, would be particularly valuable to a sports marketing consultant. Do the universities, with dwindling attendance to their football or basketball games, do they hire consultants to help beef up the attendance of their sports?
Yeah, they're trying a lot of things. You know, basically, they need a Bill Veeck kind of guy to come in and say, here's how you put things to happen at the game, before the game, the tailgating and all that, just to make it more than just the watching of the game. Remember, most of these teams are not that interesting. I mean, most teams are losers. There's one or two that everyone is watching. So how the real problem we try to address in the book is, if you are a losing team in the Cubs, be a good example of this in general, and they've found the miracle because they keep their fans. So what's the magic?
Excellent question. Answer your own question. How have the Cubs continued to be such a successful operation when they're such a lousy team?
Yeah. Well, the Cubs basically have an interesting set of circumstances. You go back to the 40s and 50s, especially the late 40s and 50s, you walk into the into Wrigley Field, it was like a funeral home. There was no one there. People forget that. There was no one there.
Uh-huh.
I was there. I remember looking around, maybe a few people. And what happened was, it became partly nostalgia. Everybody destroyed their stadiums. They were one of the two left.
Which was the other one?
The neighborhood, Fenway Park.
Fenway, yeah.
And Briggs was knocked down a few years ago, uh-huh. Detroit. The neighborhood became a social environment. It became a destination, an entertainment destination. Mm-hmm. And so baseball, it became more of a social club than a baseball operation. And some people feel that's a problem. But basically, they transformed. And they built this, the best thing they did was they retained their identity and understood the historical aspect of their operation.
They also somehow developed a few lovable stars. Ernie Banks was one
yeah,
such,
right.
Surely. He was, his style was large enough so that you could have fun with it. The Let's Play 2 comment just worked so well. Are there people who kind of stage the athletes to give them public personalities, who advise them on how to conduct themselves publicly so as to win large public enthusiasm?
Well, you know, we did have the problem of a lot of athletes in all the sports who would either be very open to the fans and the others that would not even sign autographs and would disappear very much.
Well, a big problem on the Cubs was Sammy Sosa was a star, but people didn't like him.
Yeah, that's right.
Why did they dislike him?
Well,
arrogance, perceived not caring about the fans so much. Misunderstanding, perhaps. I think a language problem was sometimes an issue for him. And also, in the end, you know, he couldn't live up to his billing. I mean, steroids and the cork bat.
All were
issues with
right.
Sammy Sosa. But you ask an interesting question. I mean, you're asking really the fundamental question of what makes some franchises work and others don't.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it comes down to understanding the connection point between, you know, what really draws us to the sport itself. And in the case of the Cubs, you really have to talk about nostalgia and social currency, for example, is really important to that operation.
When we get to the phones tonight, which we'll do quite shortly, on 591-7200, and in fact the lines have just been opened, we return then to our three guests of the evening, Irving Rain, Philip Kotler, and Ben Shields. All of them, or the three of them, to be sure, the co-authors of the new book, The Elusive Fan. What advice do we have for the other team in town? I was thinking of baseball, and I'm thinking of the White Sox, and I'm thinking of Jerry Reinsdorf, whom I don't particularly know. I think I met him once, but he comes from my neighborhood. He comes from Bensonhurst in Brooklyn, where I was born and raised. And the White Sox, I suppose they make money. I don't know, really, if they're an effective sports organization with a high level of profit. But lots of people I talk to say that they go there, but they're not happy. They're not happy with sitting in that stadium. They're not happy with all the commercialism that's pushed upon them to buy things while they're in the park. And it's just not good, old-fashioned, serious baseball. What do you do about people who have that complaint?
Well, I think that, you know, in the book we talk about the utopian connection, which is basically the nostalgia feeling. Now, I think that to the White Sox credit, they've been doing quite well this year.
Well, if you win the World Series, that should give you a leg up.
Absolutely. I mean, there's no denying that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, though, they have put together a stadium where they are satisfying all fan expectations. In other words, what we're dealing with in the sports industry now is trying to get the fan to leave their home, which is connected with all the technologies, and go to the stadium and have a comfortable experience. And I think that U.S. Cellular Field, in contrast to Wrigley Field, has all of the amenities that one might expect in a stadium.
So most people like it. It's only my stuck-up friends who are annoyed by
all
the commercialism.
If we just look at the numbers, it does show that most people are liking it. In fact, the Sporting News recently released a poll where they're almost saying that the White Sox are taking over in terms of the most popular team in Chicago.
So I'm misinformed by those University of Chicago characters.
That's an interesting. You bring up an interesting point about the type of fans. I mean, who goes to the game and how they feel about it is absolutely essential. I mean, and one of the problems is segmentation, which has always been an issue for sports, but particularly now with all the sports that are operating. What type of people are you looking for? We're seeing more and more finite analysis of fans. I mean, it's gone beyond 18 to 24. It's become
there's no way to take working stiffs and make them fans of polo, I suppose.
it's interesting. Polo's pretty much disappeared from, I mean, since Photo Play and all those other magazines. Yeah. And
Errol Flynn. As a marketer, I feel that we could market anything.
Could you market polo?
Yeah, sure.
A good example.
In fact, I even went to watch polo in Sarasota, which I had never seen before. It's very local there, and it's a big thing for the whole season during the winter. I think that what you have to do, see, I think what we're basically dealing with in the book is that as times change and as there's new technologies and social and economic factors, every industry has to re-examine its place and its strategies. And even within every industry where you have sports and teams, each team has to ask, how relevant are they? We know we use a concept in marketing called the product life cycle. And not that every organization is going to go through an introductory stage, a growth stage, a mature stage, but you got to worry as a business, a sports business, are you still relevant? And if you're not, if you're losing relevance, how do you recapture it? And that calls for some real, that's why this book is for consultants in part, for team owners, for team managers. It's how to make their team work.
But for fans as well, I'm sure. And whether you're a team owner or a manager or just a fan, if you're listening and you want to pose a question or offer a thought or a recollection, now's the time to give us a ring. 591-7200. One or two lines are available. We'll go directly to your calls after this. And back to our seminar on sports marketing with the authors of the new book, The Elusive Fan, namely Rain, Cutler, and Shields. Sounds like a law firm, but in fact they are three co-authors. 591-7200 is the number. Here, gentlemen, is the first caller. Hello, you're on the air. Hello, are you there?
Hello, I'm here.
Yes, sir.
Yes, I want to say thank you. I appreciate the program. And actually, Professor Cotler was my advisor many years ago at Kellogg, so I've really enjoyed hearing your program. My question is actually twofold. First of all, from your studies, who do you find is really doing this right on the professional or amateur side? Are there some companies or firms that you would hold up as examples, maybe like a Duke in basketball or Northwestern in football or someone else? And then the second question is, do you think the fun is going out of the game with the increase? As money increases, does the fun go out for the players or for the fans?
Good questions, both. Let's go to Ben Shields on that.
I'm going to give you a best practice example that might be not so obvious. It's on the high school level.
Excellent.
And it's South Lake Carroll High School, which is just outside of Dallas. And they're a school that has basically branded their football program. They are taking kids from elementary and middle school, teaching them the offense. They have instituted a spread offense that is completely entertaining. And they're also industrializing the program with internet merchandising and a large-scale licensing operation. So basically what's happening is they're benchmarking the major college and professional football programs and bringing it to the high school level.
How do they do in turning out bright and educated students?
Well, I mean, that's a difficult question. I mean, they definitely turn out good football players. But in terms of the actual program, I mean, it's a benchmark for high school football, and that's what we're seeing in the industry today. So, in terms of your question, I mean, I think on the high school level, we're seeing a major sea change in what's happening.
Yeah, over something like $440 million was spent last year in high school sports facilities, and a lot of it was spent on sports medicine, and all of it basically in competition. I mean, trying to excel in one way or the other. I mean, it's really an escalating kind of situation. The second aspect of the question is I think even tougher. I mean, is the fun gone out? It's certainly different. Sports is really different. I mean, you think about the bonding experience, camaraderie, all those types of things that went on in sports 50, 60, 70, 80 years ago. Some of it idealistically probably incorrect. We have a case in the book about a fifth grade, sixth grade football team and how they dressed. I mean, they wore their own Mustang uniforms with crayon on it, funny helmets, you know, each had different shoes, funny pants. I mean, whatever it would take to play, no parents at the games, no coaches, they did it on their own. And that was the kind of thing that was standard operating procedure. You contrast it today, you find parents, professional coaches, fancy uniforms, incredible leagues. What's the name of the league in California?
Snoop's Youth Football.
Yeah, that's a great story.
Which is run by Snoop Dogg, the rapper.
I really have to persist. Pardon me for being sort of a moldy fig old professor, but you do have to ask, how does this relate to the Scholastic program? Does it tend to augment it and facilitate it, or does it take away energy and take away interest and enthusiasm so that, in fact, you don't get a very good performance in the classroom? Today, there's new SAT data just released, and we've had the lowest SAT scores around the country for the last 20 years.
Yeah, I think I have to make a statement about that. I remember in the state of Texas, Ross Perot, who, as you remember, ran for president at one time, complained very much that the high schools were so filled with sports that we were not producing educated citizens. I have a brother who is absolutely thinks sports ought to be out of the school system, completely out. I think that's an extreme. But there is a corrupting influence on the part of sports.
Well, is that the answer then?
Well, the answer is every school has to figure out what the right balance is.
Is it an inverse relationship? The more sports you got, the less scholastic achievement?
There's no evidence.
That's an empirical question, which is an extremely good one.
No, yeah. That defies logic.
It defies logic.
If you look at the best high schools in the state, where are they? And what kind of athletic programs do they have? New Trier, by far, the best athletic program in the entire state.
Well, they've got a lot of money.
Maybe so.
They have a high tax base.
But they have excellent academics and excellent students and excellent...
Well, I would like to believe that is the case. We go to another caller quickly, 591-7200. Good evening.
Hi, Milt. This is Ador. I wanted to give you a call because at the beginning of your show you were talking about what sports would you make up, and it just gave me some childhood memories.
Oh, yes?
My father was a janitor in Detroit. He worked for a auto parts manufacturer. And with him and some of his coworkers, what they would do on their breaks is have sweeping competitions. And so I thought, you know, your comment before about polo not being for the working stiff, maybe broom sweeping could do that. They actually got to a point where they'd start bringing in their own types of dirt and kind of spread it out over a 50-foot stretch of the machine floor, the manufacturing floor, and time themselves to see how quickly they could sweep it up. And these guys took it as a pretty serious competition for bragging rights, and of course our father was thrilled with it because he then would come home and tell us about it, and we would try to top him on the weekend, so it helped him get some of the chores done around the house. And so maybe broom sweeping could be the next big craze for the
applying your idea, we could go into a lot of businesses and have people do more racing to get the job done. Let's take just garbage removal, and there's a lot of trucks that are out there, and maybe we can give a big prize to the one who does the most in the least time.
Absolutely.
Sir, we thank you for the call.
All right, thank you.
And we are due for a last round of commercials, which we'll take care of quickly. Then right back to your calls on 591-7200. If you'd rather reach us by email, that email address, extension 720@tribune.com. Gentlemen, we go to another caller, and you are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening, Milt. I was just wondering if your guests had commented in their book, possibly, or maybe earlier tonight, about the success that NASCAR has had with their marketing and their internet, because it's a full experience when you go to a race, actually, or you can now you can log on to your computer while you're at home and watch pit crews. You can listen to in-car audio and stuff like that.
Gentlemen.
Well, I mean, NASCAR is a classic case of transformation, which is what we emphasize in the book. I mean, they went from a regional sport to one that's national and even growing international in scope. And the point about technology is very important, but also NASCAR is really the textbook case for establishing the star power. In other words, the NASCAR fan can identify with their own stars. They tend to buy the products that those stars endorse. And they really are a strong marketing machine. And one of the interesting things about NASCAR is that they are taking the technologies from home and bringing it into the stadium.
So do you think that other sports could maybe learn something how NASCAR does what they do to make other sports more popular?
Well, sure. I mean, I think that some of the sports are trying to emulate others, but I mean, a lot of it depends on who their target audience is, what their brand is going into the marketing situation. So, I mean, there are lessons to be learned, namely, I think, the ability to produce these stars and distribute them with new technology.
Sir, we thank you for the call.
Thank you.
And time being short, let's come to a serious kind of futurology, if that is possible. This is the year 2006. What will the sports profile of America be in the year 2056, 50 years forward?
I don't think the major league sports that we all know about, basketball and baseball and football and so on, will be as popular as they are today. They'll still be around. I think that there will be so many other sports. Here's one of the problems that the major league sports have become very commercialized, and I suspect there's a reaction to that. They're very expensive to attend, and of course they do bond people because they're so popular and visible that we can connect with other people by just talking about these highly visible sports. But I think there will be much more fractionation of audiences distributed over many, many other sports, and we'll form almost groupings.
Well, where will they go?
They'll go to extreme sports. They'll go to quiet sports like bowling and billiards and things like that. Participation sports. There's so many choices now. One of the questions we've been trying to investigate is if more young people grow up with a certain sport, let's say they opt for baseball, are they going to be long-term baseball fans? Is there an influence on people of the sport that they start out playing, and do they stay with it? It's hard to predict 50 years. I don't think we can predict 5 years away, Milt.
Irving Rain, your thoughts on the same?
Well, one of the interesting issues about this is that there's such a democratic issue in terms of sports. Suddenly, sports like paintball, extreme sports, have access to communication issues that no other sports have ever understood. In the book, we talk about three major areas: the monopoly period, which was really the ownership period before television, where sports was really white males. Then we got into the television era, and I would call that almost the Gorgeous George era, when Gorgeous George really almost invented sports on television with his wild hair, his spritzing perfume into the stands, that sort of thing. And now we have the highlight generation, where we see people watching just short periods, where gambling has become so important. What are the odds? That sort of thing. I think what you're going to see, I think Phil's right, I think you're going to see fractionation, but I think sports like NASCAR, which basically cars going around in circles, have created this entire entertainment experience, is probably the future.
There is an edge of that has to be faced with regard to NASCAR, or even with regard to boxing, say. People are aware of the possibility and the likelihood and may in fact be hoping for accident and trouble.
Sure, I mean, danger is clearly an attraction. But I think in terms of the future, you know, one of the major arguments of the book is that all sports need to be willing to change to meet the expectations of their fans. And so you take a sport like cricket in an international market. Cricket used to be a 5-day-long, 1-day-long sport. I mean, it took forever to play. And so they were losing market share, and they were losing the young audience. So what did they do in England? They changed the game. They still have the 5-day and the 1-day versions, but now they've reinvented the game in something called 2020, which is basically a 3-hour-long made-for-television event. So those are the kinds of examples that we're talking about in this book, where sports have to understand the need to change to meet the expectations of their fans.
You know, what we're really saying, too, is that every team is a brand, whether or not they consciously plan themselves to be one, which means that people will perceive them in a certain way, and that it's much better if they don't take the audience for granted and they really do positive branding, where they try to differentiate themselves and their virtues from other competitors. And our book is about branding a team and transforming.
And if you've forgotten, the title of your book is The Elusive Fan, Preventing Sports in a Crowded Marketplace.